Welcome to the Hatch podcast for Hive.
This is Eloise interviewing poet, radio broadcaster and Barnsley Poet Laureate for Hear My Voice project, the one and only Ian McMillan.
Well, hello.
Thanks for doing the interview, Ian.
Thank you.
How did your writing journey start?
Well, I would think it started when I was very, very young because I've always lived in Darfield and I was born in 1956. And in the 50s, 60s and up to the mid-70s, Darfield was part of a part of Yorkshire called the West Riding that was a separate education authority that had a chief education officer called Sir Alec Clegg, who was a genius, who said that all children are creative. So in my school in Darfield, Low Valley County Primary, we just wrote all the time. So we'd have a lesson, then we'd sing about it, then we'd dance about it, then we'd make some art, then we'd make a sculpture, then we'd write, and then we'd perform what we'd written, and then we'd make a book. So it just felt like the most natural thing in the world. The writing was not something that other people did and you didn't do. Mm. It was just the thing that you did, and it was the most amazing thing. We'd have string quartets that came, we had abstract art on the walls, we'd do a poem every lesson, it was brilliant. My wife was a West Riding teacher, and she said, you know, you go out, you find a log, you bring the log back, put it on the desk, write about the log, make a book about it, stick it on the wall. That's what she always said, find it, write it, make a book, stick it on the wall. So it just felt, that's when it started, just writing all the time, writing and thinking, well, writing's a natural thing to do. And then the West Riding, again, the West Riding Library in Darfield, that moved from being down Low Valley up to this new library in 1964, all these books that you got for free, that you read. But then this book that I got called Writing for Money by a fellow called Harvey Day, Writing for Money. And I got this book out and it was brilliant. And it was like full of like wise tales. So it said, so-and-so wrote 800 full-length books, but only got his 801st one accepted. And so-and-so couldn't use his arms or legs, but wrote 3 books with his head. You know, stuff like that. And I kept borrowing it. And it would just say things like, just give you advice on writing. It made you think like writing could be a job. Mm. And this fellow Harvey Day, I would love to make a radio programme about him because he wrote all sorts of things. And I found this list. I found the book in a second hand bookshop and he wrote the first book of Curry's, the second book of Curry's, the fourth book of Curry's, and all these other things. But he never wrote the third book of Curry's. And you wonder why. And Mrs. Dove, I borrow this book so often, she let me keep it. She said, keep it for a bit. So that was it. That's when it began. So when I was about 3, I think, four. When I went to infants at Low Valley, and the first thing I wrote was a story that went, the giant came out of the mouse hole, and a lesser teacher than Mrs. Roach would have said, giants can't come out of mouse holes. And she went, that's great, and she gave me a stare, because that was the West Riding thing. Mm-hmm. The book to look at is one called The Excitement of Writing by Sir Alec Clegg, and in that he had writing by writers and writing by school kids, and put them next to each other to show that we can all do it. So that's when it started.
Sounds like paradise.
It was paradise. It was. The thing was, it then didn't prepare you for the world. Mm. And then I went to Wath Grammar School, where we had the teachers weren't West Riding, but we had one fantastic teacher, Mr. Brown, who got me back into writing. But I remember, I often tell this story, that I was so thick, I thought SA was spelled S full stop, A full stop. And I put my essay by Ian McMillan, future Nobel Prize for Literature winner. And he took me on one side and said, Ian, Nobel Prize winners don't come from Darfield, which I disagree with. I think they can. But he was great, Mr. Brown. A lot of us maybe could point to one teacher who really got us going, and he was the one. So, yeah, it's something I've always done. Never thought of doing anything else. What else could I do? I'm unemployable.
Your influences when you first started writing, and what are they now?
When I first started writing properly, there were comics. My mum used to go and get her hair done in Greta Houghton once a fortnight. She'd come back, she'd go to a newsagent called Jack Brooks. It's not there anymore, it's a pizza place in Greta Houghton. And she'd bring me this brown paper parcel, and this is a long time ago, this is the 60s, with comics in. Beano Dandy, Beezer, Victor, and what she called a commando book, which was like little. And I'd read them and I think, this is great, this is fantastic. At the same time, I'm getting books out at the library. I never saw any difference between them. who were just writing, exciting writing. So I'd write comics. I wrote epic comics. That's when I first started writing epic comics. And so the comics just influenced me so much. Then when I started reading properly, that's not true, when I started reading novels, my big influence was, I read a lot of, as a child, I read a lot of Enid Blyton and Biggles, by Captain W.E. Johns. Biggles was like an airline pilot in the First World War. He had three mates, Ginger, Algy and Bertie. And Ginger was meant to be the son of a Durham miner, although he didn't speak like a son of a Durham miner. And then Biggles was in the First World War, the Second World War, the Korean crash. He was in them all. Anyway, so then I read him, and then I started reading John Steinbeck. He was my favourite. The Grapes of Wrath, Of Mice and Men, The Wayward Bus. Amazing books. And in terms of poetry, I didn't read a lot, but then Mr. Brown, the aforementioned secondary school teacher, gave me a book by Ted Hughes. He gave me Crow, Ted Hughes' 1970 book. And he went, here's a book of jokes by a comedian. You'll enjoy these. I read them, and they made me laugh. And he said, by the way, they're not jokes, they're poems. I thought, blimey. And then we were doing this book called Nine Modern Poets. So it had people like Dylan Thomas, Philip Larkin, John Betjeman, all men, all white men. Amazing. And all these, but the weird thing was, Nine Modern Poets, photographs on the cover, it never told you who was who. So for years I thought Philip Larkin had got a head of curly hair, he's bald. And I got into Dylan Thomas, which is fatal when you're 15. It's like, and I was writing all this Dylan Thomas influenced stuff. So Dylan Thomas in poetry. But then I went to college and in Stafford and was still reading stuff and standing up and performing it. And in those days there was a network of folk clubs all over the place, with three or four in Barnsley, where they had these singers' nights that were like open mic nights. And you'd turn up and just do your stuff. And they were great, they were so welcoming. You'd read your stuff and they'd go, good old lad, clap their hand. Then somebody else would get up and sing their own song, then somebody would get up and sing a traditional song. And if they forgot it halfway through, nobody cared. It was great. So me and my mate Martin, he's dead now, but we used to work together and we'd do comedy and poems, and that's what first got me started into enjoying being a performer. Previous to that, I'd been in a band, but just enjoying just standing up and doing it. So then these days, my influences, I read such a lot. I read all the time, you know. When I go home tonight, because I went out at 7 o'clock, there'll be two more jiffy bags full of books. It's great. Books just keep arriving. My wife says, why don't we get all these books? It's because I've been presented a show about books on the radio for 16 years, so they're going to keep coming in. But at the moment, my big influence, my favourite, in terms of performance, I remember getting into John Cooper Clarke, Dr. John Cooper Clarke, who was so good, partly because he had a northern accent, which was great. Whenever he sees you, John Cooper Clarke, he knows you vaguely, but he always has a thing to, like, he goes, all right, lad, how's the project? So then you go, yeah, I'm still writing, John, all right, see you. And so then he knows, how's the project, lad? So my favourite poet of all time is a fellow called Roy Fisher, who was a poet from Birmingham who died a couple of years ago, and I just loved his work. And one of the first readings I ever did was in 19... like proper readings, not just standing up in open mic. It was in... it'd be 1978 in a pub in Toddington, which is not far out of London. And he was the headliner. Me and my mates were like the kind of support act. I remember it being the weirdest gig, because they said, right, you're going to stand up and do your poems. And Roy Fisher did some of them. Me and my mate did some of them. Roy Fisher did some more. But the organiser was drunk, and he kept standing up, and he was selling vegetables. So you're doing this poem, and he stands up and he's going, get your carrots. And this other bloke was, I'm going to kill that fella for doing that, for interrupting the poets. And this other chap shouts, the drink has destroyed him. It was fantastic. And as a kid, I was a teenager, thinking, God, this is great. This is how the literary life should be. But then the best bit was, like, they calmed this fella down. And then this chap ran in, Jack Trevor Story, who was a novelist, and he's dead now, but he ran in, and he had a cape and a flying helmet and goggles. And he ran around the room shouting, I am the president. And then he ran off, and I thought, this is what you want. This is how it should be. Because that was Roy Fisher. The other thing was, there used to be a magazine called The Urbane Gorilla in Sheffield, years ago, edited by a fellow called Rick Kavanagh and a fellow called Tom Owen. And they used to look really scary. They had Tom Owen, like, a fierce And I saw him at the Ilkley Literature Festival, and I bought this, I was looking through this magazine, The Urbane Gorilla, and I was looking through it, and I was like, I don't want to buy it, don't handle the effing merchandise. I went, oh, I'll take out a subscription. And he went, we have readings upstairs at Red Deer on West Street.
Yeah.
I said, right, and it was the most amazing thing, because you go in, and I walked in, and there was a fella reading his gas bill, and his mate improvising on two saxophones at once. Bloody hell, I thought, this is it. So that was influencing the way, you know, standing up in these weird rooms. And that still happens everywhere. But Roy Fisher was the one for me, because he just... And John Cooper Clarke in terms of performance. And also the Liverpool poets. Adrian Henry and Brian Patton and Roger McGough. And Roger McGough and Brian Patton are still going. Adrian died. But I saw him there. There was a Doncaster Literature Festival years ago, and they did a thing at the Brewery Taps in Doncaster. And that was amazing. And I saw Ted Hughes do a reading. Well, he stopped halfway through. He went, I can't do any more. He says, I'm spent. I thought, oh, that's fantastic. So that was it. Just like excitement to seeing these people perform. it still happens now, of course, but they were my influences. But also I'll be influenced by every book I read. Mm. What am I reading at the moment? I'll show you. This is a bag full of stuff. I'm just reading Louise Gluck. It's one of my favourites. She's great. She's an American poet. So Vicky's going to read that book while we carry on chatting. I'll tell you what, this is my other vice. The New Yorker magazine. Oh, I love it. They're a poem, they have stories, they have cartoons.
Have you been in New York?
No, never. We'd like to.
That's this time, yeah.
That's
no,
this
I
time.
I listen to their podcast.
It's good, isn't it? The podcast is great. And it's cheaper. I mean, it's expensive to try and buy it in a shop. But for a subscription, it's only 120 quid a year, which isn't bad, because it comes out every week. It's fantastic.
What draws you the most to poetry?
I think the way that it's democratic and that anybody can do it, and that even if you can't read or write, you can speak it. You know, so I like theatre, I like art, and I like all these things, but to make theatre, you've got to have a space, and you've got to have a plot, usually, you've got to have props, and you've got to have other things. But to make poetry, all you need is a blank sheet of paper, or all you need is your voice. And if you can't speak, all you need is get somebody to help you to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like a completely universal form that's been going on forever and ever, and whatever happens, it's not going to break. So that's what draws me to it. It's democratic, and it's kind of endless resilience, so that whatever happens, you know, when I first started, I thought it was a kind of precious vase, that if I dropped it, it might shatter, but it's not. It's a thing that will just carry on. And if we fail, it don't matter, actually, because somebody else will come up and do some more, you know. So it's like that, isn't it? That's why I like it, because it's cheap to do, you know. It's not like if we were setting up, if the residency was a kind of opera residency. I mean, I like opera, I write operas, but if it was an opera residency, we'd have to have a lot more behind us, you know. We'd have to have a band, we'd have to have a stage, we'd have to have singers. But if it's poetry, don't need much, do you? So that's what attracts me to it.
You can cut me out. I think that's one of the sad things about not a lot of working class, not people not being it, for me, from my background, because I feel like it's free, it's easy, it's cheap,
yeah, it is.
It's something you can do.
It is.
And but a lot of people think it's not for me.
Oh, they do. That's always, that's the constant battle.
It's not for me because of X, Y, and Z.
It's the constant battle. I know, it's very exciting. And it is, like you say, it's democratic, and anybody can do it. And that's the great thing about it. That's what attracts me to it. And the fact that it'll carry on when I've gone, you know, it's not like something that's going to fade away and it's going to get stronger, I think. Especially in these turbulent times, you know, I think a lot of people do turn to poetry at times of either great personal turbulence or, like, national, international turbulence, like we're having now. So, yeah, that's what attracts me to it. These are great questions.
How did the radio work start, and what do you like the most about presenting The Verb?
The radio work started, a mate of mine was called Dave Sheesby, and he was a radio producer at Sheffield. And in those days, it's hard to believe that the whole afternoon sequence, the whole afternoon on Radio Sheffield, from 1 till 4, was education. It was plays, it was things for schools, things for adult education. This guy, Dave Sheesby, rang me up and said, I want to interview you about your writing. So he interviewed me. I made him laugh. He said, can you make me laugh every week? I always, my advice to people is always say yes. Always say yes. It leads to great adventures. I said, yeah, I'll make you laugh every week. I thought, I've got no idea. Kind of, I don't know. So he said, can you write me a thing every week? It's called Letter from Barnsley. And just a little 15-minute, it's not live, record it. We recorded that. And then, and it was on in the afternoons on Radio Sheffield. That's where it started. And then they invited me and my mate, Martin, to review the papers on Radio Sheffield. That was a live thing. And the first time you do something live, you get very nervous and your voice dries up and you're doing that and you're doing that. But then I enjoyed that. And then Dave Sheesby said, do you want to present a show on Saturday mornings on Radio Sheffield from 9 till 12? Me and my mate. I said, yeah. He'll go, blimey. So then do that. And that was so exciting. So exciting. Live, you know, just... And I like doing stuff live, because if you say something, it don't matter. If you get it wrong, it don't matter. So then Dave Sheesby moved to Radio 4. And he said, you got any ideas? I said, yeah, I had no idea. So sent you an idea, thought of some ideas. Wrote a thing called The Blackburn Files, which is like a detective story set in Sheffield. It was set in Barnsley. And then made documentaries. And then, about 16 years ago, they got a new controller at Radio 3. And I love Radio 3, but I always saw it as a kind of an elite thing. And I was in a hotel in Bournemouth. And the boss of Radio 3 rang up. And he went, would you like to do a pilot for a show on Radio 3? And I went, okay. But then I felt like I'm with the big boys here. Scary. So then I did this pilot for this thing. It was originally going to be called Saturday Speakeasy. And then it was going to be called Pure Verb, because that's a line of a Chamusini poem. So I did a couple of pilots, and then they went, we'd like to present this thing called a verb. And I went, all right, I will. And it was so exciting. And I've done it for 16 years now. And the best thing about it is, there's so many great things about it. On Radio 3, you can stretch out. You can do what you want. You can ask people difficult questions. You can get people to mesh with each other. You you don't have to just say, that's your bit, then your bit's done. Then it's your bit, then your bit's done. And I've got a fantastic group of people, because for 10 years it was down in London, which was great, had fantastic producers. Then they said, Ian, good news, you're moving to Salford. The programme's moving to Salford. And I said, you think the North's a small shed, and Salford is just there, and Barnes is there. And in fact, it takes me 20 minutes longer to get to Salford than it does to get to London, because you get Barnes, Sheffield, Sheffield, Manchester, get the tram, whereas I'd just go to Doncaster, get a train. Anyway, so now I've got these amazing people. My producer, Faith Lawrence, who is a poet, who just a little collection out from Smith Doorstop. Jessica Treen, fantastic knowledge of prose. And just every week is like an absolute joy. So last Saturday we recorded one of the last night of the proms. Before the last night of the proms, obviously. So we had Michael Palin talking about his new book, which is about a ship that got lost on a voyage to the Antarctic. Jason Singh, beatboxer. Anne Dudley, who wrote the music for Full Monty. And a fantastic poet from America called Mojde Stokely, who was a slam champion across in America, and she wrote us an instant poem. But the great thing was, my producer talks to them all and made the whole thing kind of fit together. So every week it's like, so my routine is I write the script on a Saturday, I go meet my producer, she rings us up, we have a chat on a Wednesday, I go across to Salford on a Thursday, we go through the script again and again and again, and she'll keep thinking and thinking and thinking better ways to make this work. And then before the show I always give the guests apples. We have a little apple thing and they have apples. After the show we have cake. And we try and make it like a party. So it's great. And at the end of it I'm buzzing with ideas and excitement. And we've got a new boss at Radio 3, and you always think they're gonna sack it. Whenever you do old freelance they're gonna sack you. And it had to go out to tender, which meant they had to be bid for. But in the end, we got the show for at least another couple of years. So it's great, and it's the most wonderful thing. I said it does mean that everyday books keep coming in. Not books that we've asked for, not books that we want to read for the show in particular. So we're doing a special on a novelist called Barbara Kingsolver. She's written loads of books, so we get loads of hers, and that's all right. But I know that people want to be on the show, send books, which is fair enough. So I'm on the list of all these publishers, and they send books, which is great. So the verb is just the best. It's just so much fun. So much fun, and it I think it seems to be, it's all right for another year, you know. But the best, it's easy really, because I'm talking to people and at the same time the producer's talking to me down the headphones saying, do that, do this, do that. And once you get used to that, it's not easy to start, once you get used to it. The only time it went wrong was, there's a novelist called Nicholas Royal from Manchester, And there's also an academic called Nicholas Royal from Sussex, and we got the wrong one. And he was down the line, the wrong one, from Brighton. So we were sat in London. And I said, no. And I turned, we're doing a programme about Freudian influence in novels. So I said, I turn now to the novelist Nicholas Royal. And I said, I believe Nicholas, and he's sat in Brighton, I believe Nicholas, there's a lot of Freud in your novels. And he went, Ian, nobody's ever read my novels. And I said, oh, I think you've been a bit disingenuous because I've read them all. And he went, they're all in my drawer at home. I've never sent them out. They've never been published. Then my producer, who was called Asya Lodi, she went, get out of this one. So then I said, all right, I confess. It was with a festival called Hear My Voice in Hull, and we're doing a live one from there. Live is much more fun. We did one last year that was live. We had a wonderful women's group, a collective, who'd done some poems, and they promised us, between you and me, they'd learnt them, and they hadn't. So we said, right, so you've learnt the poems. We went, yes, we've learnt the poems. We said, right, so we're on live, you'll be on about 10 past 10. It's live, that's it, I'm live. They knew it was live. They said, we haven't learnt the poems. I said, right, okay, that's fine. I haven't learnt my script, we just read it from the thing. They went, the script's at home. I said, that's all right, that's fine. So they said, we've got the script here on iPads, so we'll print it. I said, that's a great idea, so I'm going to print the poems. But then it was a room a bit like this, at this college in Hull that we're doing the show from, and the only printer was right up there. So we had these senior BBC executives running down with scripts to give these people. So my producer's going, just make sure, just a learning thing. But when it's live, it's more exciting. And it was almost called, like I said, it was almost called Saturday Speakeasy. I'm glad it wasn't. And it was almost called Pure Verb, because that's that line out of that Chermasini poem. But now it's called The Verb, which is good.
You must have met some interesting people in your career. Mm. Now, other than the ones you've already told us about,
yes.
Who stands out and why?
I've met so many interesting people. I'll tell you what, very early on, there was a poet called Harold Massingham, who was in the same class as Ted Hughes at school, but has always been a bit forgotten. And he was such an interesting fella. He came from Mexborough. He wrote these amazing poems that were really difficult. And when I met him, he had a real odd charisma. And I saw him do a reading at Lumbank at the Arvon Foundation. And he turned up and he had a white shirt on. He had like a goatee beard. And he said, I am the complete sensualist. I drink lager and I take snuff. And I thought, blimey. I'm a young man. I'm going, God, this is fantastic. And he read these amazing poems. So he was one. He was one of the most amazing people. I'm thinking about him because I've just been reading about him. There was a guy called Ken Campbell, who was a theatre maker and writer, and we had him on The Verb a lot, and he was an amazing person. His thing was improvisation. He said, you've got to improvise. Improvising is the thing. And he set up these improvathons, where he'd just get people to improvise for 24 hours. Because you've got to get your lizard brain. You stop thinking and you get your lizard brain. And he was the most amazing person. And he did these fantastic things for us on The Verb. Like he'd say, he was a Shakespearean actor as well, and he said, if you forget your lines, you just let the other actors know by saying a line that includes the word nub. So he said, I have the nub, my liege, which means you've forgotten your line. And then you just make some stuff up and then come back to it. But we did a live Verb once, and he had these actors around him. He just kept making them do things. So he had one of them, and he'd say, give me a number between 350 and 200, and he'd give him a number, and he'd make the actor count backwards from that number aloud whilst writing a sonnet that you'd given the subject for. And just amazing. So Ken Campbell. And also, one of my favourite people is Liz Lockhead, who was a wonderful poet from Scotland. She was one of the first people I met in terms of performing. So Liz Lockhead, Ken Campbell and Harold Maskin. But if you asked me tomorrow, I'd say there were other people, you know, because I'm lucky that I meet lots of people. He's the poetry police. Tough on rhyme, tough on the causes of rhyme, as Billy Bragg said.
Has being Northern and having an accent ever affected how you're seen or how you work as a poet?
Well, it's never affected me in terms of how I see myself, but often people think all kinds of things, like they think you put your voice on. They think, oh, it talks like Prince Charles at house. I can't stand that Ian McMillan. You get a lot of that. You know, he puts it on. Professional Yorkshireman, you get that. Weird. the idea that... Somebody said to me the other day, do you maintain a base in Barnsley? I said, yeah, I call it my house. You know, they said, but they didn't believe that somebody can live here and be cultured and interesting and intellectual. And people do sometimes think that I put it on, but I don't. And sometimes I know that I'm picked as the token northerner for things. When they've got a panel, they'll pick a northerner, and it might be me, because I'll say... Yeah, me or Kate Fox, yeah. So I'll say, here's a northerner, here's a northerner. I remember, again, a thing about not living in Barnsley. This telly thing rang up. They said, look, we're doing this programme, it's on Thursday night, and I want you to talk about living in Barnsley. It's live on the telly. I said, all right, they gave me the date. I said, I can't do it, because I'm doing a gig that night quite near where I live. They said, we'll send a car. I said, well, I won't finish the show till about 10 o'clock, and the radio thing, the telly thing's on at 11. They said, oh, well, which part of London are you in? I said, no, same thing. I said, I'm not in London, I'm in Barnsley. They said, well, I said, well, you want me to come on and talk about Barnsley? And again, they said, we don't think you live there. We always use Michael Parkinson as an example, because he talks about Barnsley but lives in the south. So fair enough. But I talk about it, me and poor old Dickie Bird, we live here. But no, it's never affected me. The older I get, the more you kind of become a bit accepted, I think. You know, and people... I've just been doing voiceover for this show on Channel 4 called The Dales and Lakes, which is a nice programme. And I had to keep going later in The Dales and Lakes before each advert break. And this fella on the train the other day went, he came up to me, he said, just say later in The Dales and Lakes. So I went, later in The Dales and Lakes. I went, oh, great.
You couldn't make that.
You couldn't make it up. Then Sean Bean, who's from Sheffield, did a voiceover and a thing, and they thought he was me. This fella said, I heard you on the radio. I said, I said, you didn't? You had Sean Bean is bloody Blade. I'm a Barnsley fan. These are great questions.
Oh, thank you.
No, they are.
And they're very well said as well.
Yeah, they are. They are.
Okay. Is there anything that young writers have now that you wish you had when you were starting out?
Yeah, the internet. We didn't have the internet. Hard to believe. We didn't have the internet. And so you would write a poem... And I used to think you had to send them off to magazines flat. So I'd get my mum to cut up cardboard, like cornflake packets, to fit an envelope. And you put the cornflake packet cardboard in your envelope so that your poem was flat when it got sent off, and you'd send it off to a magazine. And about 5 weeks later, it might come back. And it would come back eventually. There used to be a magazine called Outposts, edited by a fella called Howard Sargent, from Walton-on-Thames in Surrey, and I'd send him these poems, put cardboard in the poems. Dear Howard Sargent, I enclosed 3 of my poems for your consideration. I enclosed stamped the rest envelope. Post them off. Sit, waiting. He'd write back. He never took any of my poems, but he'd always send this rejection slip, but he'd say, do send more. So I think he likes my poems. So I'd write some more, get my mum to cut the things up, send them off. Do send more. And eventually... After years, it's just because I get stuff published in other magazines and get stuff sent back, but he do send more. And eventually I realise he just don't like them. He don't like my poems, which is fair enough.
He says it to everyone.
Yeah, he says it to everybody. He says it to everybody, do send more. So that's the difference. That in those days, you'd have to send stuff off. You'd have to think, who was that person who wrote Diddly D? So you'd go down to Danfield Library, you'd look like that, you'd ask your mate. Nowadays, it's all there. So I wish we'd had the internet. I do wish we'd had the internet.
That is something that's actually quite apparent now I think about it. Mm. Because I've only ever sent a competition entry off once in the post.
Right, so it's not always going to be on email.
Yeah, it's always been online by email or something like that for me.
Yeah, that's true. And it's something that never occurred to us because it didn't exist. And when it started existing... Yes, I wish it had been around, because then we would have had a wider... Because now any poem I ever want to find, I can find. Any performance I ever want to find, I can find. There's nothing lost anymore, which is a bit of a shame in some ways, but then that's just somebody from my generation saying that. You know, so the fact that everything is at our fingertips is a definite bonus, I think. And also, of course, as you know, I like Twitter so much. I won't even be able to tweet all the time.
It's a little Twitter, Twitter's great.
And it's not... It does just disappear into air. That's why I do my early morning stroll tweets. You see somebody tweet it. Then he could have emailed me saying, do send more.
But at least it'd be less
less conflict packets. And the bloke at the post office, I used to take these things down to send these, and he'd go, more masterpieces.
Yeah, now they prefer, like, but we wouldn't want to discourage you from entering again.
Well, that's it, partly because competitions, they often ask you for a 5 or 20, so...
From the opposite perspective, is there anything that you had when you started writing that you wish young writers today had?
I suppose it is the other side of the coin that we just talked about, that young writers these days will always have that everything at the fingertips. And so I quite liked the mystery of not being able to find things, which will never happen again in human history. You know, whether you'd think, what was that thing? Where was that thing? Who wrote that book? What is that tune? Who said that? And so it was like, knowledge was a mystery, whereas now knowledge is a very practical thing that you can find anywhere. So I suppose that's it, that's what it is. That sometimes you wish that young people had that sense of possibilities, not possibilities, that's the wrong word, of things that you can't quite grasp. Because they're, but these days it's like a Google whack, you're never going to get one that you can't find on Google. So I suppose it's that really. So the world was very mysterious for me when I was young.
A bit more sacred, almost, yeah. Isn't it?
Like there was a novel called Small Creeps Day by a fella called Peter C. Green that I read once as a kid, then I lost it. And it was about a fella working in a factory, and he decides, I'm fed up with this, and he walks through the factory, past all his mates, and out through some door into a kind of lost world. And I thought, and I used to have fantastic memories of that book. And then through the internet, I managed to get it from it. And then I read it, and it was quite good, but not as good as I thought it was when it was a mystery to me. It's an interesting book, but...
Is there anything that you would say to the young poet version of you if you could go back in time?
I'd say take more opportunities. I took plenty, but I remember winning getting third prize in a competition in New York, and I won something like 10 quid, and the idea was I was going to go and read my poems, my winning poem, and I was so nervous that I didn't go. And I said, I remember on the morning saying to my mum, I didn't go. And then going and sitting in Darfield Library and wrote to the woman, because they didn't have a phone, wrote to her saying, I'm sorry, I haven't been. And she wrote back saying, you silly boy, you should have come. So it was that, you know, taking every opportunity that's offered. I took many of them, but not all of them. So I would tell my younger self that. And maybe work harder at school, Macmillan. Because I'm quite, quite good at engaging people and stuff, but then sometimes when they ask me the second hard question, I know that I ain't got a lot of intellectual hinterland behind all this kind of bluster, you know. So that's my clever producer, Faith, at Radio 3. I've got a degree in English and politics, but I should have worked harder. So I sometimes wish I got more intellectual depth than just kind of skating along, which I do all the time, you know. And I'm not daft, you know, but I'm not an academic, and sometimes I wish I was more able to articulate stuff.
But at the same time, ticking boxes and getting grades.
No, that's true. And in my day, it wasn't like that. In my day, it was ticking boxes and getting grades wasn't part of it. It was just, even at grammar school, just a lot of fun. Worth Grammar School, same school as William Hague, former Tory leader.
Was it Romarsh?
Aye.
Yeah.
His dad made a lot of money out of fizzy pop. Pop millionaire.
Okay. What have you enjoyed about being Barnsley Poet Laureate?
Well, I know I resisted the name for ages. When they contacted me, said, do you want to be Barnsley Poet Laureate? I said, no. Can I be Barnsley Poet Champion? Or Barnsley Poet Czar? I wanted to be Poetry Czar. Because I don't like that word laureate. I find it, not that I'm ever going to be asked, but if they asked me to be Poet Laureate, I'd say no, you know, because. So then they said, we'd like you to be Poet Laureate. And they kind of more or less gave me Chinese burns and said, we'd like you to be Poet Laureate, you know, and I went, Because the thing is, because I've been here a long time, they all know me, and so when I'm walking about, he's here, don't say, oh, they'll write a poem about it, you know. He's, put that in, he's a poet and don't know it. Hey, also what's good about it is, here's a poem I've written. I write poems, you know, you get a lot of that when I'm at the football. Put that in the poem, put that in your poem. And I thought, that's nice. I like being a public person, I like being in public. There used to be a fellow go around Barnsley, he'd stop me, I've got a quick one for you, Ian. Here's a quick one. And he'd sit down. Tell you a poem. Get it all the time. I've got one here. So then I felt that Laureate felt like you were kind of distant from that. But in the end, like I said, they gave me Chinese Bird and Steve out and like got me in a knucklehead and said, come on. So I went, go on then. So what I've enjoyed about it is kind of it's legitimised what I do anyway. You know, so I do it anyway. I wouldn't do it if I'd still do it if I wasn't it. And also it's been like, it's concentrated the mind wonderfully because they've gone, we'd like to write a poem about this, about Tour of Yorkshire. Oh, right, then, well, it's a good idea. Done that. And what I like about it is that what I'm writing is not aimed at people who read poetry. It's aimed at everybody. It's aimed at people who read chronically. It's aimed at people who never read chronically. It's aimed at people who don't read poetry. And so that's nice about it. So it's a public kind of thing. So that's what I've enjoyed about it. And it's nice in the end. I decided I did like the word in the end. Poet Laureate. My mate drew a picture of me with a lorry on my hat. And poet laureate. That'd be better, wouldn't it? Or a hat made out of a lorry, that'd be better. Poet laureate.
You're judging Hive's Young Writers Competition early next year.
Yes.
What do you look for in a competition poem?
Well, I always think a competition poem, in some ways, is different to a poem. Because a poem, you can write a poem, you can take it to a writer's workshop and a group, and you can talk about it. And it's like up for discussion. And you go, oh, I see what you mean. What about that third line? They go, well, I might alter that third line, I'll do that. A competition poem, it arrives, it's got to stand on its own 2 feet. It's got to say, here I am the best poem you've ever seen in your life. And so I want to be startled, that's what I want to be amazed. I really want to be astonished by these poems. I want to see poems that break rules and that make me... if I'm wearing a hat, I want my hat to go on my head when I read the poem. Because to me, there's no point sending in a poem that might just be one of the poems you've written. It's just a poem. You know, it's just a poem that will be part of a sequence that you might want to put in a book, or it might be a poem that you'll take along to a group to talk about. You know, they're good poems. They're definitely good poems, those. But for a competition poem, it's got to be a poem that will... that if you enter in a competition, you may as well try and win. So it's got to be the best thing you've ever written and the most different thing you've ever written. So that when the judge reads the first line and the judge thinks, I can see what's coming next, then you go, wait a minute, I was wrong. Then you read the third line, you go, blimey, I never thought of that. So it's that's what you want. You want something that's going to astonish the jaded judge. I think as well that when you send a poem in, maybe it shouldn't be your first draft. Maybe you should look at it and really polish it and make the judge be amazed. I know that Hive have got fantastic hints and tips on how to edit poems, because it's not an easy skill. But if you can look at their hints and tips, that'll show you how to do it, because I wish I'd had people giving me hints and tips when I was younger. So if you look at the hints and tips, work on the redrafting, send me something that you, if you were a judge, you would give it the prize to.
So, last two questions, and they're kind of related.
Okay.
Is there any advice that you were given about poetry that's really stayed with you?
I asked somebody what poetry was, and he said it's the music of what happens. And that's what I like, the music of what happens. So that wherever you go, whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you encounter, is a possible poem about to happen. So anything, absolutely anything that you see or hear can have music in it. So the music of what happens, that's my favourite phrase.
It's got potential to become a song.
Yeah, it does. And just anything that happens, you can make a poem of. People say, oh, I can't think of one. Of course you can. Look out a window. You know, people say, I've got writer's block. I say, well, you don't get bricklayer's block. You know, bricklayers don't stop laying bricks. So I've never been a... Just use everything that happens to you as the idea for a poem. What's he called? Hugo Williams. Fantastic poet. And he writes very much about his life, about his... the intimacies of his life, and he wrote this poem about splitting up with a girlfriend, but then put, even as we leave the room, I'm working out where the line break's going to go, in the poem that I'm writing about this. You know, so everything that happens to you, big or small, can be grist to the mill. And also, carry a notebook, write stuff down, because something will happen to you, and you'll forget it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't write it down, then all you remember is that you had a good idea. So I favour the... I like the blank without lines. Moleskin notebook for me.
I'm more of a lined person. Lined,
well, everybody's different. I mean, writing's not very neat. And the theme is Frankenstein. And so I've been asked to write a kind of vocal thing that's going to be broadcast over that. And what I like about being asked to do that is it's things you would never think of doing yourself. That's the thing about saying yes. I always talk about the most amazing thing I ever did when somebody rang me up via my agent, and they said, we'd like to write a sonnet about Domestos bleach. And it must include the phrase, the champagne of the smallest room. I said, all right, yes. I said, yes, I can do that. And they said, we'd like to write it and come down to Leicester Square, and it's National Toilet Week, and we're going to build a giant wooden toilet, put it in Leicester Square. You're going to sit in this special thing in the bowl, read your poem out. It's going to be on breakfast telly and radio. I said, yeah, I can do that. So I wrote this thing, and I get down to Leicester Square, and they because it costs money to like rent bits of Leicester Square, they're only going for half an hour, from 7:30 to 8 in the morning. So these fellas, and just putting the finishing touches to this giant toilet, and I'm stood there with it, and they said, here's your poem, and they framed it, my little poem. Oh, so I said, all right, shall I go and read it now? They said, no, because the telly aren't here yet, the papers aren't here. And then this tiny woman, like, approached and stood next to me, really close, and she had a carry bag. I didn't know who she was. Hello, hello. Like that, and she's following me around, I didn't know who she was. So anyway, then it dawned on me, but not on anybody else, that nobody's coming, because it'd be like a PR disaster. So they get a phone call. Breakfast telly's not coming. ITV's not coming. Channel 4's not coming. Telly's not. Oh, radio's not coming. Two Counties Radio aren't coming. Hospital Radio's not coming. Sometimes that happens, you know, they set these things up. Then at 8 o'clock, this kind of knocked on this door, and these fellas got this van, dismantled the toilet, took it away. PR disaster. They paid me to write the poem. They paid these fellas to make the thing. This woman, it turns out, with a carrier bag, was one of the chief executive officers of Domestos, who'd come to see what happened. So, like, she was cross with these PR people. I said, I'm sorry, she said, it's not your fault. Then she gets this carry. She went, anyway, I write poems. I said, dear? She went, yeah. She said, can we just have a look at these poems of mine? I went, go on then. So, I thought, this is the most expensive poetry workshop you've ever had. And the only thing we did get, in the Martin Rosen, the political cartoonist who does stuff for The Guardian, he heard about it. He did this fantastic cartoon of me sitting on the toilet, like, pooing out terrible poems, and I like writing these poems. And he gave me a copy of it. So that was a result of saying yes, and it led to interesting encounters.
I still can't believe there's a National Toilet Week.
I think it might only, it was quite, I mean, there's National Week for anything. This is a long time ago, this must be about 8 or 9 years ago, and it was just, it felt like, when they said it, it felt like a good idea. And, you know, Domestos...
Why not? It's always worked for us.
It's always worked. And to write this poem that went champagne in the smallest room, I was quite pleased with that.
Last but not least, I'm sure you'll be glad to be free of this.
No, not at all. I like talking about myself.
Any pearls of wisdom from yourself to young and emerging writers in South Yorkshire or anywhere?
I would say always believe that you can do it, that believe that it's not an exclusive club, or if it is an exclusive club, it's actually an inclusive club that everybody can join. Write poems all the time, read poems all the time, find out where things are happening. Hive will tell you where things are happening. If things aren't happening near you, maybe try and start something. Maybe get together with other people who write, because you often think that you're the only one. And in fact, there are lots of people writing everywhere. So I would say, keep your eyes and ears open, keep your notebook open, and keep your book of poems open that you're reading at the moment.
Sounds like good advice.
Well, yes. I can't give advice on anything else, because I've got no other skills. I can't give advice on riding a bike, because I can't. But I can give you advice on poetry.
Well, thank you for doing this interview. It's been lovely to talk to you.
It's been great talking to you.